This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. At the bottom of the hour, my guest is Barbara Powell from the Irene Goodman Literary Agency, and she is what I call the instant girl, because she turned Tracy Chee's book, The Reader, into an instant New York Times bestseller. So I'm looking forward to talking to her again. But meanwhile, my first guest is really quite a remarkable woman and a remarkable author, Nancy Peacock. Her book, The Life and Times of Persimmon Wilson, is really quite incredible. And I am so pleased to welcome her to the show today. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Patsy. How are you?
Fine. Wow. You know, I'm holding the book in my hand, and it's I'm holding it up to the camera because we're also on podcast. They did a beautiful job with this book.
Isn't that a beautiful cover?
Beautiful cover, embossed in the inside with the map of the United States in color, and really just beautifully done, high quality paper. They have taken your book and really made something, lovely just to hold. But it's the story, and I can see why they've done this, because this is a book that I think is going to be well accepted in so many areas of the marketplace, because it's an important book. And, you know, writers always want to be able to step into the shoes of their character. And in this case, you've stepped into the moccasins of your character, because it is quite an unusual and a very impressive book. Let's talk a little bit about it, then I want to talk about how it came about. But first, now tell us basically the story of it's Persimmon Wilson, who is a slave, and
right.
Tell us about him.
The book opens in 1875 in a town called Drunken Bride in Texas. Persimmon Wilson is a black man, a formerly enslaved person who is about to hang for the murder of his former master, which he admittedly committed, and he committed this murder while he was riding with the Comanche Indians. So it kind of bookends these two cultural events, or, you know, historical events in America's history of the enslavement of black people and the genocide of the Indians as well.
Well, you really take the readers on a journey. You go through the entire process from when he became a slave, and how it's so impactful. I think in this book, you have really captured the emotion behind what it meant here to be a slave. It's horrific, and I at one point I said to myself, how could you live this book? It's in some ways it's painful, you know, what right. you had to write here, because it's just quite hard for us to imagine how terrible this was.
Those were hard times. I will tell you how this book came to be. I was actually taking walks in the early morning, in the dark. I would walk 3 miles, and I would arrive at the top of a hill, and I would watch the sunrise every morning. And I'd been doing this for months. And I was up there, and the sun was coming up, and all of a sudden the opening line, "I have been to hangings before, but never my own," just arrived in my head. And I went home, and I wrote it down. That evening I was watching Ken Burns' documentary, The West. And I began to wonder, while I'm watching that, if there were any black Indians. I knew there were white Indians. I knew there were children who'd been captured young and assimilated into certain tribes and actually became warriors or mothers of warriors. is a very famous case in Texas. But, yeah, so I just sort of started following that thread. The first chapter just, it almost lays out the entire book, and it just poured out of me.
Well, as I'm reading it, I'm thinking in a way that you were possessed. It's one of those books where you think, well, I know this woman wrote this book, but on the other hand, I'm so sure that you're like your whole mind has been taken over by Percy Wilson.
I would agree that it was sort of a possession. I think I really believe that stories choose writers rather than writers choosing stories. But, you know, being possessed doesn't mean, you know, I couldn't cook dinner.
Yeah, no, I know that.
Still drive to the store. It is a kind of interesting thing to write a book and be obsessed with it and have, you know, you're living two lives. You're living the life that's fictional that you're working on and discovering, and then you're living your own life, and you have to pull out of each one.
And one, in reading this book, one really feels that you're releasing him. You're bringing him to life the way he wanted it, the story told. And it's hard to believe that he wasn't a real person, because I was so sure, you know, at some points that he's actually writing this and not you, who I happen to know is, you know, one of the things in your life, you actually cleaned houses. You were a housekeeper. And so, you know, I'm thinking, whoa, here she is cleaning house or doing things, normal things. And yet all the time her mind has this story building up and just growing and bubbling over. It's quite amazing.
Well, cleaning houses gives you lots of time to think. And it empties your mind out a little bit. So, you know, that's not a bad thing. Physical labor really is not a bad thing to be doing for a writer.
No, well, it's funny. After I read the book, then I went and found out that you were actually a housekeeper and know all about cleaning houses. So we might touch on that.
Right.
At some point. It's so funny because my I one time had a housekeeper, well, briefly, because my problem was every time she was coming over, on the day that she was coming over, I would clean the house first because I just couldn't do it to her. I couldn't give her a mess. My husband said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I think you're working harder now because you have a housekeeper than you worked before." You know? So I gave it up. I gave it up. But
It's intimate work cleaning somebody's house, and it's intimate work writing a book too.
It is. Now, you know, how did the research, you did an amazing amount of research between what slave life was like, what being a slave was, then of course Percy escaped at one point and is with the Comanche Indians. So you've done research on so many different levels here.
I have, and it was fascinating. As I said, I knew that there were white Indians because years ago I'd read a book called The Captured by Scott Zetch, which was about children captured by the Comanche on the frontier of Texas and assimilated into the tribe. So that was, in some ways, I read that book years before, and it stayed in my mind, or it stayed in my heart. So in researching this, or when the idea for this came to me, it was really about a man who was once a slave, a black man riding with the Indians. And because I was familiar with the Comanches, I just, you know, I chose the Comanches. And from there, I knew they rode in Texas. I worked it backwards to a Louisiana cane plantation of like, well, how did he end up with the Comanches? Well, he came from Louisiana. He was on a cane plantation. It turned out that a lot of the slave owners and the plantation owners in Louisiana, when New Orleans fell, they started taking their slaves to Texas because they did not want to lose them.
So, oh, I know that because we lived in Texas quite a few years, and uh-huh. we had one of the nicest parades that we would have would be when the black cowboys would come out and be in the parades, because of course they were, you know, the great great grandchildren of the slaves, but they maintained their cowboy life interests. And so it was always a beautiful sight to see them there. And yes, you're right. So many did head off to Texas.
Well, in some ways, the facts were fitting with the story. You know, I had to find the facts. It was sort of like a little jigsaw puzzle. But a lot of times I found things that just fit with what I was doing. And if they didn't fit, then I knew I was sort of on the wrong track and I needed to find what did fit.
Well, there are so many details in this book, and between the details and the very, very beautiful writing, I can see the poet in you, in your writing, because there are phrases and areas where it just flows so beautifully, like poetry.
Thank you. Thank you.
Beautifully
done.
Very
eloquent man.
Well, you have created an amazing character here.
I joke that, I mean, he writes his story in 3 days before he's about to hang. And I joke that he's a better writer than I am because he got it right in the first draft.
Exactly.
Three or four drafts.
How long did it take you?
It took me about 2 years.
2 years. Now, am I right that you self-published this book first?
I did. I self-published it in 2013. I had three books that were traditionally published prior to the self-publication of Persimmon Wilson. And I just wanted to try self-publication, see what it was like. I learned something. And so I did that. And successfully, it won the Writer's Digest Best, Mainstream Fiction category of Best of Self-Published Books in 2015. So it did well.
Okay.
I got an agent and signed on with Atria Books.
Well, I think that's very encouraging to self-published authors that they can. Sometimes they think, well, if I self-publish, that's the end of my, you know, big career with a literary agent. But that's not true. If a book is good, it tends to be found. And your book is just quality. It's a quality writing.
Thank you.
And so it's very encouraging. And obviously, Atria believes in you because they have put when they turn out a book and do it with really such a high level production, you know that they believe in you. And I think
I really love the product. I think it's just beautiful.
It is. It is really, really beautifully done. Now, did you face? Was there a question about the fact that you're writing a book about a slave from a slave point of view, and that you're not black? Did that bother you?
Well, it's certainly a sensitive issue, and my approach to every book that I write and every character that I work with is one of deep respect and deep honor, and I just try my very best to honor the story and respect the character and get out of their way so they can tell the story through me. So I know that this is frowned on by a lot of people. I think also sometimes, though, for a writer, a story just arrives and...
I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. It's there. If it's in your mind, it's part of you. You have to write it down.
Right. That's really true. And I think, my criteria for saying yes to a story is that I can't say no to it. And that's the way this one was. You know, and it's again, writing is just a very intimate relationship. It's very private. It was just me and Persimmon Wilson working this story out and my research books and all that. But, you know, it's when it's published that it becomes less intimate. It really starts belonging to other people besides me. And
I think that
an artist has to, or for me, I have to work with the premise that I have every right in the world to make a fool out of myself, and then try very hard not to do that. And
you kind of have
to just free yourself up.
You know, from my point of view, I think it would be wrong for people not to accept this book, which is so sensitive and so touching, based on color of the writer. Just like if a black writer writes a book about a white person, I'm not going to say, oh, well, you can't do that. you know, because
they could probably do a really great job.
Absolutely. And because it's just when the it's exactly that, when the story comes into your mind and when you see the characters, you see them as they are to, you know, in your mind. So you don't I could be writing a story and it might be about a Chinese person. For me, the person is Chinese, but it doesn't make any difference to me what color anybody is. So I think that's why I think this book is really a valuable book, because anyone who reads this book will be touched by this story and will learn so much. I was from the very first page, the details of people actually going to hangings and enjoying them. I mean, it's hard, you know, we're facing so many problems in this world, and you just wish that people would find their better minds, find their better selves. And I think your book can open people's minds to, you know, how exactly, what are people thinking about?
Well, there's a lot to learn from history, and I feel like we haven't really faced our history in America particularly well. I learned a lot about Reconstruction while writing this book, and although the slaves were freed after the Civil War, they weren't really given their freedom, because all these laws were created called the Black Code that limited their movement. And so they could be picked up if slaves in Texas didn't have a contract for labor by January, they could be picked up for loitering or for vagrancy, I think it was, and put on a chain gang and made to work for free on the roads and so on. And this was the beginning of the whole prison chain gang system.
Well,
it
you know,
didn't end until the 1950s.
That's why I think this book is important. It makes the subject so very compelling that you really want to know more and you really want to understand. And I think by the end of this book, a reader wants to be a better person.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you.
And that's why I would recommend this book to people, because it really is a book that changes your mind, that opens your mind. And there were so many things that we don't have time to talk about. All the things you mentioned, that you had some knowledge of Comanche lifestyle, because that's fascinating. And I had not known some of these. I love the part about the shield.
You could use it against bullets?
Yes.
Isn't that fascinating?
I always love in a book when I find things that I don't know. And there were quite a few things in this book I didn't know. But tell us just briefly about this shield, because this was fascinating, and I think people will find this interesting.
I didn't know this either, and I was really interested to find it. And I hadn't given shields much thought, but shields were made of buffalo skin stretched taut across a frame. They were two layers, one on the front and one on the back. In between, the Comanche would put crumpled paper, if they had paper, and they often got paper from raids, and that actually made it more impervious to bullets. So you could actually use your shield to, I don't know how to say it, you know, you could hold it up and it would ping a bullet away from you.
Well, they developed the first bulletproof materials, which,
right.
I mean, that's now what they're using, sandwich materials.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. The new materials, they have this sandwich of different layers in order to you know, be bullet resistant. So it was fascinating that the Comanches were doing it so long ago. This is one of the joys of this, reading this book, for all of the you know, it's a love story, of course, the love story of how Percy follows the love of his life as she's taken away by a slave master. And this is a very beautiful love story.
Yeah,
and
they
I think
have a very deep love.
Very deep, and that's where I think some of your you know, finest writing comes in. There's this touch of poetry, and
I think of Chloe, his love, as a very strong female character.
Oh,
too.
She is.
She to some people, she seems passive. She enters the story as a house slave who's being abused. But she really does. She knows how to get what she wants, and she does do her best to do that, as I think many slaves would manipulate situations as best they could.
Well, survive. I think you did a great job, Nancy Peacock, and the book is called "The Life and Times of Persimmon Wilson." And do you have a web page that you want people to go to?
I do, www.nancypeacockbooks.com, and you can hook up to my Facebook page where I have I also post things about creativity every day.
Okay, that's great. And your book about housekeeping is still out there too.
A broom of one's own.
Yes.
It's about writing, house cleaning, and life.
Well, that I think that's a great book for all writers because
it's encouraging.
It's exactly, absolutely encouraging. Well, you've done a beautiful job, and I'm so happy that a major publisher has picked this book up and that you're out there promoting it, because I think it's a book that people should read.
Thank you so much.
So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay. Well, I assume you're working on something new?
I am. I'm working on another historical novel, but I don't talk about works in progress in detail.
When it comes out, we'll have you back on. But meanwhile, I want to recommend to everyone The Life and Times of Persimmon Wilson by Nancy
Thank
Peacock.
You.
Bye, Nancy.
Bye, Betsy. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then I'm coming back with a comedian.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Looking for a good book? Then get over to Miami Avenue Book Nook in Indian Rocks Beach. Check out the latest books from local authors like Angela Hunt, who wrote the book for the film Risen, or Bonsu Brenvick, whose books preserve the memories of the Bellevue Biltmore Hotel. What do you enjoy reading? A thriller? A romance? How about a mystery or a sci-fi? At the Book Nook, you'll find it all. Remember, one of the joys of life is to read. Located in Indian Rocks Beach, look for the blue building with the mermaid on the side, on the corner of Miami Avenue and 2nd Street, two blocks south of the post office. Open Tuesday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. and Saturday, noon to 4. And don't forget, while you're there, check out Miami Avenue's great collection of Florida wines, local art, and fantastic gifts. Miami Avenue Book Nook, where you will be inspired to read.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my next guest, Barbara Poile. And I introduced her as the comedian, but better known to my listeners as the Instant Girl, because she took Tracy Cheese's book, The Reader, and made it into an instant New York Times bestseller. And that's a word that all writers love to hear. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Happy New Year. Thanks for having me back.
Well, it's my pleasure and the pleasure of all my listeners who really, really took all of your last interview to mind everything from the hook, the book, and the cook to the fact that you referred to a book as being so wonderful that it's like the Eiffel Tower covered in chocolate. So so I really had a lot of wonderful comments about you. I didn't realize at the time, of course, I discovered afterwards that you are a comedian. So perhaps that's why you came across so very well.
Well, yes, I do have a former deep, dark, secret life as a stand-up comedian and actress in L.A., but those years are long behind me, along with my ability to digest dairy and run a six-minute mile. So that's how long ago that was.
So, well, what's new in this in the publishing world?
Well, I'm glad you asked. You know, it's always so invigorating to come back in January. I think that people take much-needed breaks in December, no matter what your break is for or over or whatever religion you practice. The break is necessary, and I think people come back with their boots on the ground in January ready to really focus on signing some great folks, and I mean that on the agenting side and the editorial side. I know that you had Brenda Drake on recently.
Yes.
And she, I'm a huge fan of Pitch Wars. I don't know if you know this, but Tracy Chi, in fact, was from Pitch Wars.
That's right. Tracy told me.
Yep. That is how I stumbled upon her, because my author, another number one New York Times bestseller, Renee Attia, who wrote The Wrath and the Dawn and The Rose and the Dagger, she was Tracy's mentor in Pitch Wars. And so she was like, elbow, elbow, wink, wink, Barbara, you got to see this. So that, to me, is a near and dear. And I also signed the amazing, illustrious M.K. England, who wrote a book called The Disasters. And Harper will be publishing that in spring 2018. And that's a young adult sci-fi. It's kind of like The Breakfast Club meets Firefly. It's witty, it's pacey, it's fabulous, and that was another Pitch Wars. And to be honest, if I were to go through all my Pitch Wars connections, I bet you I've done about $1 million in deals just from the Pitch Wars font of goodness.
Ooh, that's nice. I'm going to have Brenda back on because she's doing that little Pitch Madness in February.
Yep.
And so I'm going to have her back on to, because already so many of my listeners are anxious to they're looking forward to August when they can start doing Pitch Wars, but they can have a little dip in with this Pitch Madness in February.
Yeah, and I would encourage folks to just stay open to opportunities like that, because I think that it's just another tool in the writer's toolbox. I ended up signing this year. I signed an author named Christy Gorzin, a Canadian author. I loved her book. It was actually a surprise to me, because I'm not usually one for this type of format, but it's a YA novel, and it's told entirely in verse. But it's a story of a young girl and her efforts to join an art school, and it translates so beautifully in verse, and I just had to have it. So I got another one out of the Pitch Wars this year.
Wow, this is exciting. This is exciting. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was thinking about, every writer I know wants a New York literary agent, and I know that, of course, you are inundated all the time with questions. By the way, last time we spoke, you had, I think, 1,093?
Yes, and I am down to 215. Look at me.
Oh, my.
Look at me doing my job.
Wow. So you used your break for some real serious
yes.
House cleaning there.
Yeah, a lot of reading, much needed reading.
And when you do you don't like to do any more of those little mini pitches, quick pitches.
Right, the face-to-face pitches. I don't.
Yeah. You don't have the nerves for it.
Difficult. No, and it's not even that. It's the authors sometimes don't have the nerves for it. I mean, I can sit across from anybody and talk for hours. I don't care. But for me, it's so stressful to watch the author struggle to articulate their writing, and it's sort of like, well, if I'm going to buy a car from you, I don't want you to tell me about the car. I want to get in the car and drive it and see how it rides. So for me, it's like, I'd rather have you walk up to me and hand me 10 pages. And I invite any of your listeners at any time, if they ever should encounter me in the wild, I would have no problem with you saying, hey, you said I could bring you 10 pages. As long as you have the stomach for it, I'll stand there and read it right there if I have a chance and give you a quick rundown. But to me, the proof is in the pudding, you know, and if you're not going to spoon me up the pudding, there's no real use for us talking about the book. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely, you know, in being in the screenwriting business in Hollywood, you have to have these elevator pitches, and people go crazy just trying to think of them.
Oh,
they go
hard.
Have nightmares. I think people have had breakdowns, Which is why...
I've seen people weep in front of me. Absolutely. And here's the thing, Patsy. You're right. You need to know how to talk about your book. That is on you. That's on the author. You need to know how to talk about your book. And the elevator pitch is an excellent way to just condense premise, not plot. We're not talking about plot. We're talking about the premise of your novel. It's a great way to train yourself to be able to talk about your book. But it certainly doesn't make or break whether or not I sign a client. In fact, two of my most successful clients, Sophie Littlefield, who has about 25 titles to her name, and Graham Brown, who's a number one New York Times bestseller, they're the worst pitchers for their book. Like, when they call me and talk about their new book idea, it's gibberish. And I'm just like, just send me some pages. And they're so immensely talented, but it doesn't translate for them. You know, Sophie will spend 5 minutes talking about a character's grandmother's aunt and what she did in the war. And I'm like, that has nothing to do with the book. What are you talking about? And Graham is just like off on some tangent talking about the Toyota Motor Corporation at one point. And I'm just like, what is the book? But these guys write, you know, New York Times bestselling books. So to me, it doesn't necessarily, it's not a translatable skill to be able to talk about a book and to be able to write a book. So I prefer to just see that pudding. Hand me over the pages.
Well, how did Nick Petrie do with you?
Well, he is such a fabulous story. So Nick, and it's actually pronounced Petrie. So
Petrie.
Nick
okay,
Petrie
that's
is
good.
A client of mine. Thank you for bringing him up.
Because he's going to be on. I'm glad you told me how to pronounce his name, because he's going to be on my program on, I think, February 7th.
Well, as of this morning, he is now Edgar-nominated author Nick Petrie,
because
The Drifter, his first book, was nominated for an Edgar, and the news came out this morning.
Wow!
So we are all very thrilled. He came to me years and years ago in 2008 with another book called Crooked Izzy, and I loved it, and I signed him. And then the bottom kind of fell out of the housing market, and Nick works as a home appraiser and contractor. And there was a lot of struggle on the publishing side of things, too. There was a lot of tentativeness about publishing debut authors in hardcover, because the public wasn't able to shell out $25 and take a risk on someone new. So there was a lot of, weeble wobbling in the publishing industry about hardcover debuts there for a good chunk of time, 2008, 2009. And he ended up saying, you know what, I'm just going to go away for a while. And he came back years later into my inbox with the draft for The Drifter. And I read it, and I was very relieved, because I went through my records and saw that he never dissolved the agency agreement. And I said, I'm already your agent. I'm shopping this tomorrow. And it went to auction, and Putnam bought it. A wonderful, brilliant editor named Sarah Minnick. And he is now... just written book three, just turned in book three, but we are just so thrilled, because the illustrious Lee Child gave him such a wonderful compliment and wonderful blurb, saying in effect that a lot of people say that they have the next Jack Reacher, but Peter Ash is the real deal. And Peter Ash is, of course, Nick's protagonist.
Yeah.
So the real just salute and bow from Lee Child, who's just a delightful man and so generous. And, you know, his book is just raging up the list. It was in EW last week, Entertainment Weekly magazine last week, in the reviews, and then it was in the week before on the must list. So, and that's the second book, Burning Bright. So The Drifter nominated for an Edgar, Burning Bright just tearing up the charts right now, and I could not be more thrilled for this author and the time and effort and energy he's put into creating this character in this series.
Well, his book is very exciting.
I
really enjoy his work, and this is one of the things I always tell people. You know, he has an ordinary job, and I recently I had an author on, a local author, and he was a mailman, and you know, I have another girl who's a great author, and she works in the electric company, and you know. Mm-hmm. I always tell people, you don't know who the people are around you. You know, sometimes people don't talk about, well, I'm also writing, until, you know, maybe they get this New York Times bestseller, but they're just, you know, they just go out there and they're doing this. So you never know who's writing a book. That's why it's so important. It's important to, you know, get to know people.
Absolutely. But I think when you talk to Nick, too, he has such a great love and respect for the people that he works with when he's walking into people's homes and giving them appraisals, and especially a lot of returning vets. And that's where the character of Peter Ash really got all the dimensions from. And I think that, you know, asking him about that will be just a wonderful and fecund source of material to dig around in, because I think that's very true. I mean, a lot of people's big dream is, you know, quit the day job, but a lot of people's dream is to just do it all, do both, you know, have your own business, have be a writer, and move forward to just kind of spinning all your plates on every stick, you know?
And when you have a job like he has, that he's mm-hmm. drawn so much of his character and so much of,
right,
which yeah. really makes his book feel real. You know, if they know their subject, mm-hmm. it really translates into their writing. So, he's a great writer.
Yes, he is. And what you're saying there is really true, and I want to circle back with that. There are so many people that maybe wouldn't find what they do to be an interesting, or think a reader would think it was an interesting occupation or profession. But that doesn't really mean anything, you know. In all honesty, there, writing what you know can help be a cornerstone for a really accessible protagonist. I have another author, Eileen Cook. She writes YA, and she has worked with people with traumatic brain injury. And in With Malice, the young girl has a traumatic brain injury. Now, it's not the focal point of the book, but it adds this realism and this dimension to the character. And it's, she's just writing what she knows. And I think that, you know, if you're a mail carrier, or if you work for the electric company, I mean, anybody can stumble upon and solve a mystery, or anybody can fall in love. And having something comfortable that you know about writing about can often, like I said, be a great foundation for creating a unique but accessible manuscript.
That's so true. And I just, that's why I just love meeting writers. I love talking to them and finding out, you know, I was just talking to a fantastic writer before you, Nancy Peacock, who wrote The Life and Times of Persimmon Wilson. She was a house... she was basically a cleaning lady. Housekeeper mm-hmm. is a fancy term. She cleans people's houses for years. I mean, she was writing books, and she was doing, you know, people's dishes and scrubbing their tubs. And this is what she was doing. And mm-hmm. I'm sure people would look at her, the people who were hiring her would say, oh, she's my, you know, cleaning lady. Mm-hmm. And all the time, her mind is like working, overtime. And she came out with this brilliant book, The Life and Times of Persimmon Wilson, about a former slave who, you know, escapes and eventually lands up being with the Comanches. And it's an exciting and fantastic story. And that's why I find it so interesting to learn what a writer's background is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's a good starting point, too, for someone who's stuck. And it's a good idea as far as how to help shape your protagonist. Give them some of your own traits, you know, cheat a little. Give them something to give them extra dimension, but also make it accessible and real and you know, authentic.
Exactly. And, of course, just if you're a family, don't bring too much of your family in and so that they can recognize it, because then they might get mad. But... you know, if you write a book, you can bring in your sister, because your sister sounds like a hoot.
My sister is a hoot. My sister is a hoot. She
because I have like I have an older sister, too. And mm-hmm. yeah. Older sisters can be very funny.
Yeah, she's a hoot. I mean, she probably weighs 105 pounds soaking wet with rocks in her pockets, but could take me any day. I'll tell you that right now.
And I understand she punched great. You.
Oh, at which time? Yes, growing up, we were. It was the true definition of the best of friends, the worst of enemies. All growing up, I mean, I couldn't ask for a better sister. I couldn't ask for a better best friend. Growing up, and even now, I mean, we have such a shorthand way of speaking. I think that nobody in our family will play us in games anymore, like charades or taboo or any kind of Pictionary, because you draw one line and the sister already knows what you're saying. So I'm very lucky to have a sibling, and I'm very lucky to have such a fabulous one at that. She's a real hoot.
Did she really play that joke on you about the president?
100% true.
Tell that story. You have to tell that story, because that is funny.
I was in second grade, and I had to do a report on Abraham Lincoln. And when I was working on it at home, my sister told me that all presidents have to get assassinated in office, and I gave that as part of my report and got yelled at by the teacher in front of the whole class. So, but you know what? Like Lucy and Charlie Brown with the football, I still believe her when she tells me stuff. I still say it as gospel, so she can still have as much fun with me as she wants, because I'll say, "Oh, really?" and run with it. So it's a relationship that we have our roles cemented and I wouldn't have it any other way.
Well, I think it was delightful to hear about her.
Yeah, I mean, that's just one of many, many stories. But I'll tell you this, she is also a very avid and voracious reader, as is my mother. And a lot of times, if I am struggling on a manuscript, I will be like, hey, do you have an afternoon? Can you read? What do you think of this? And she weighs in on things for me, which is, I mean, that's worth its weight in gold. And she keeps threatening me that that she needs to be on the payroll. But just when I need a second opinion, she is so well-read and so versatile in her reading. And she's a fourth-grade teacher. So she's really good with not only just adult manuscripts that she prefers, but with YA and middle grade as well. So I lean on her all the time if I'm on the fence with how to fix a manuscript or whether or not to sign a manuscript. So a lot of you folks out there would have my sister Andrea to thank for me being like, okay, I see how to fix this. It's actually her helpful notes.
And it's funny, a lot of local authors have my sister Natalie to thank, because I give her, she loves mystery. She knows every mystery. I mean, she's an unbelievable reader. And I will give her the you know, when I get a mystery, I give it to her and she will read it. And she's always spot on that this one you have to interview, because this is going to be a big hit. And this writer is really talented. And so that's a wonderful thing about having a big sister.
Yeah, and a wonderful trait to share with the family, too, especially, you know, if you have things in common like reading. And it's not only fun to discuss at the Thanksgiving table, but it's also something that can be helpful for us, you know, when we're in the creative arts. And as far as just, like, sometimes you get so in that tunnel of reading so many things or talking to so many people, like, you start to lose a little bit of the definition on what's really standing out and what's really good. And so it helps to have kind of a partial impartial party weighing in for you. So, and that brings up another really good point that I wanted to discuss on this, which is everybody should be having a critique partner or a reader that they can trust. And in that case, I would advise them to not use a relative. It's hard sometimes if you are in love or love someone to tell them that their book is terrible or there's a plot point that doesn't make sense. It can be more of a loaded issue. But I highly advise folks to get involved with critique groups or online critiques group, in person, you know, book groups, that they are sharing their writing with each other, but not have them be a relative. Have you found that experience to be true with people you talk to and your own experience?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And everybody really needs to join one of these groups and have this. Well, you know, I talked to Mary Higgins Clark recently, and she still has a group, you know, the second Tuesday of every month club. And they still, and they're all, you know, big writers now, but they still read each other's work and comment.
So important.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so important.
It is. You know, my listeners are always asking me, well, what's the next book type? What genre is really hot? What, you know, should I concentrate on a certain area? And I know that, you know, quite a few of my listeners are working on young adult, which I think are quite popular right now.
Mm-hmm. You know, every time I hear that question, I grin and I think, let me get out my crystal ball. Because if I knew the answer to that, you know, you and I would be having this conversation in my ski chalet and, like, we'd be, you know, having drinks on my yacht, because it would be very easy to predict. The interesting kind of Ouroboros of this career is that the audience sort of determines what's next. Because take, for example, something like Gone Girl. Now, who could have seen that coming? It kind of crashed through the genre, the suspense genre and the upmarket section, and created its own genre. And then behind it came this flood of other books. And that was audience demand. And that was, we like this, we want more of this. So what you can kind of see is when you see this, it's almost, you know, hindsight, when you can kind of see the where a trend started. But what I would say right now especially is there is still a voracious appetite for that upmarket suspenseful fiction, that Gone Girl, Girl on the Train, The Luckiest Girl Alive, pretty much anything that you saw with Girl in the title.
I know.
That can never go wrong. I myself love the suspense and love mystery. And with that comes the same idea that you said of YA, right? YA is a voracious and robust market because they keep making more young readers. And then with that in mind, though, what I would really advise folks is not to try to write towards a trend or write towards a genre that they believe would be, and I'm doing the little air bunnies here, easier to either find an agent or get published in. But what you should be writing in is twofold. What you should be writing is what you love to read, and also what you should be writing is what your muse has grabbed you by the ears and demanded that you write. And I think a lot of folks out there will recognize when I say demand, like your muse knows when you're cheating, when you're trying to get by with something or write something you shouldn't be writing. But I do feel that reading in your genre and writing in your genre that you personally love to read is the first step in the key to having a successful manuscript, because you're going to enjoy it and you're going to find it easier to write it than to actually try to chase a trend or chase a genre like YA or middle grade. Because I'll tell you, it's a big misconception. It certainly isn't easier to write YA than adult, and it certainly isn't easier to write commercial fiction than literary fiction. It's all hard. All of it's hard. But giving yourself a little help in the beginning by writing, if you love, love, love reading, you know, Jonathan Tropper and Nick Hornby, there's no reason why you should be writing a thriller. You should be writing, you know, family saga, upmarket drama. Same goes with if you just love, love, love reading romance, but you're trying to write, just, you know, this bio-thriller YA, then no, stop, write a romance. I think that will really be the first step towards not only having a successful career, but one that you enjoy doing.
Well, I'm fearful. Now, my favorite book of the year, the last year, is A Gentleman in Moscow. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love that book. And I'm so fearful that now everybody's going to be coming out with books about set in Russia in the 1920s. And, there's going to be an overwhelming number of people who say, well, that book did so well, so now we'll write another book set in Russia in the 1920s, 30s. And I hope they control themselves.
Yeah, and you're not entirely wrong, but I think what the broader umbrella might be is the permission that historical fiction can take place in more than just Tudor England. I think for a long time there, what we saw in historical fiction was really centered on England. And so when you expand out, and then we had the, you know, Tom Robb Smith with Child 44, that was historical, you know, thriller. And then what you have here is kind of somebody that paved the way and gave permission for historical fiction to widen what's acceptable to write about. I mean, I think sometimes, like I said, when something paves the way and people say we want more of that, publishing can take it too far, and then the market is saturated with everything Tudor. And in this case, what this book did is not necessarily really refined down to we can only have it in 1920s Moscow, but saying, hey, let's open the gates for other arenas and other locales and other atmospheres for historical fiction. And I'm hoping that that's the way that lends, because, yeah, you don't want to try to chase something. You want to stay neck and neck with it.
And in the end, it has to be character-driven. You have to know that character, and you have to feel this character. You can't just, like, pick somebody else's book and say, well, I'm going to write something like that. You have to have that character within you, and that's what all of the, you know, great writers do.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, again, I just caution about chasing the trend. It's a double-edged sword. Yes, this is what I like. This is what I like reading. This is what the industry likes reading right now. But to try to pigeonhole yourself in order to get, I'm using again the air quotes, get something, isn't the way to enter a career. Write the book that you have to write, and then the rest will fall into place behind that with the work on the craft technique and detail, with the work on getting involved with critique groups and other readers, with the work on educating yourself on reference tools and other tools besides just, you know, sitting in front of your keyboard and typing. So there's just so much that goes into the toolkit of a writer. And one of those is being aware of trends and the atmosphere of the genre that you're writing in.
Okay. Well, Barbara, thank you so much for being on the program today. Again, all of my listeners have taken your basic idea, the hook, the book, the cook, and taken it to heart. And now that they've heard that your slush pile is down.
Come on over.
Are there any particular types of books that you're looking for? They're always asking me this. What kind of book would she like? And do you want them to refer in their query letter to a book, like, my book is like this book?
I do prefer comp titles, yes. I think everyone should be able to describe where their book would be shelved, you know, where Sophie Littlefield meets Michelle Gable. Those are two of my authors, for example. Those kind of things. I also think that it's not entirely necessary as long as you're able to talk about what your book is. You know that it's a upmarket suspense. You know that it's a legal thriller. You know you're able to speak to the genre of your book. But what I'm looking for is just, it's going to sound crazy, I'm just looking for really good writers. Just writers that know the craft technique in detail. I say that all the time because it's so important. Writers that can tell a story and that give me something familiar but unique. Because there's not really any new stories to tell. There's just new ways to tell them. Another cliche, but a true one nonetheless. I love YA. I love thriller. I love suspenseful on-market fiction. I was madly in love with The Nest this year when it came out, the family saga. I love family drama. Big fan of, you know, Jonathan Tropper, like I said. But pretty much anything, sides of cereal boxes, upside down newspaper headlines, like I'll read it all. So just pay attention and equip yourself with what you need in, like you would in any other career. Stay on board with what's out there right now. Take classes, be involved with critique groups, stay activated within the industry itself. And I'll be pleased to read, you know, your query in 10 pages.
Okay. Well, Barbara Poyle from the Irene Goodman Literary Agency, thank you so much for being with us today, and we'll have you back on maybe around Pitch Wars, okay?
Sure. Enjoy talking to Nick in February. Thanks so much.
Okay. You take care now. Okay.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much. Wow. Okay. If you've got a book out there and you're ready, it looks like she really worked hard over the holidays and got her pile of queries down to 200. And so add to the pile now. Get out there and send a really great query letter to her. She's a fantastic person. The Irene Goodman Agency is one of the very, very top literary agencies in the world. And if you can get through to Barbara, you will be a happy camper because she is the one who did make Tracy Chi into an instant bestseller. And she's also taking quite a few books to auction. So it would be just wonderful if you get through to her. And meanwhile, I just wanted to tell everyone that I am going to have the developer, the owner, Dave Chasen of Kindlepreneur on in February. And he is going to tell us about this fantastic website and that he has created to help people sell their Kindle books. And this guy knows everything. He's got a calculator so you can calculate the number of books people are selling, the number of books you need to sell. Everything you need to know about self-publishing on Kindle. And Dave will tell us about it, and he's going to spend the entire hour. And we're going to go through all of the steps that you need to take as a writer to ensure that your sales on Kindle are maximized. So meanwhile, this weekend, it's a beautiful weekend. Take some time to start writing your book if you haven't started, or finish your book and start working on your query letter so that you can get out there and be published. Meanwhile, remember to find your joy and share it and say something nice to somebody. And I'll say something nice to Big Ed in the control room, who's always so sweet and helpful. And everybody, just have a wonderful, wonderful weekend and write. That's the best thing that you can do. Bye for now.